Welcome to Presented Alfred Hitchcock Presents, presented by the Ann Arbor District Library. I'm Al Sheridsma. Now, if you were a dedicated Hitchcock fan in the 1950s, you may have gone from watching our last episode, My Brother Richard, on January 20th, to attending the general release of Hitchcock's film The Wrong Man on January 26th. If so, you would have found a work less like his recent Technicolor films and more like his TV show. Black and white, gritty, film noirish, even going so far as to eliminate his usual on-screen cameo and replacing it with an intro, mostly voice only, with Hitch in the distance and in the shadows.
This is Alfred Hitchcock speaking. In the past, I have given you many kinds of suspense pictures, but this time I would like you to see a different one. The difference lies in the fact that this is a true story, every word of it, and yet it contains elements that are stranger than all the fiction that has gone into many of the thrillers that I've made before.
We then proceed to the opening credits as we watch the partygoers at New York's Stork Club. It's crowded like it's New Year's Eve, although the opening of the film tells us it's January 14th, 1953. And we find Henry Fonda playing Manny Ballestrero up on the bandstand playing the bass. At the end of the evening, he steps outside, and he is bracketed by two policemen who happen to be walking along on the sidewalk. It's a nice moment that prefigures the time when Manny will find himself arrested and surrounded by police. In their article about the film, Wikipedia says that it was drawn from the true story of an innocent man charged with a crime, as described in the book, The True Story of Christopher Emmanuel Ballestrero by Maxwell Anderson, and in the magazine article, The Case of Identity, which was published in Life magazine in June 1953 by Herbert Breen. The Wrong Man had a notable effect on two significant directors. It prompted Jean-Luc Godard's longest piece of written criticism in his years as a critic, and it has been cited as an influence on Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. They also add that it is one of the few Hitchcock films based on a true story and whose plot closely follows the real-life events. So what kind of film is it? Is it done as if it's a documentary? Is it done as a typical Hitchcock film? Or is it both? Well, Patrick McGilligan in Alfred Hitchcock, A Life in Darkness and Light says, although in some ways it was the opposite of everything Hitchcock had ever done, fidelity to life was Hitchcock's unusual, almost compulsive goal in making The Wrong Man. He wanted to tell the story exactly as it had transpired, with minimal dramatic or cinematic embellishment. And yet at the same time, there are plenty of Hitchcock touches, including that one already described, where Manny walks out and is bracketed by the two policemen.
Good night, Mr. Fonda.
Good night, John.
Good night, Manny.
Good night, John.
So how did this hybrid come about? Well, Hitchcock tells François Truffaut,
I had a contract with Warner Brothers.
J'avais un contrat avec Warner Brothers.
For four pictures.
Pour quatre films.
The industry fell on bad times. There was a bad period.
J'ai rencontré une mauvaise période, une crise.
And Warner complained.
Et les Warner se sont plaints.
About the amount of money.
Des sommes d'argent.
He had paid me.
Il m'avait payé.
So I said, all right, then.
Alors j'ai dit, bon.
I will do a picture for you for nothing, no salary.
Je vous ferai un film pour rien, sans salaire.
What have you got?
Qu'est-ce que vous avez?
So they produce one or two dozen.
Alors ils ont produit un ou deux, j'ai dit,
all right, I'll do
j'ai dit, bon, bon, je ferai.
It was owned by Warner Brothers.
C'était la propriétaire de Warner Brothers.
And I did it for free.
Et je l'ai fait pour rien.
But then Truffaut replies.
Oui, mais quand même, c'est un fait divers que vous connaissiez depuis longtemps et qui vous intéressait beaucoup.
But just the same, it was a real life incident which you were familiar with and had been interested, but and which interested.
It had been done on television.
Oui, ça avait été fait à la télévision avant.
That television version, according to Donald Spoto in *The Dark Side of Genius*, *The Life of Alfred Hitchcock*, was the identified man as seen on *Robert Montgomery Presents* in December 1953. The part of Balestrero was played by Robert Ellenstein, who later, as a quiet hitman, kidnapped Cary Grant in North by Northwest. And Truffaut is right that Hitchcock was interested. As Patrick McGilligan writes in Alfred Hitchcock, A Life in Darkness and Light, Warner's was actually ambivalent about the wrong man until Hitchcock offered to waive his salary, an offer calculated to win him the go-ahead to make the picture. Although Hitchcock always insisted he made the wrong man because it was the available project, it was also precisely what he'd been after for some time. Partly by circumstance, his passion for research and authenticity had been overshadowed in recent films by artifice and Hitchcockery, and now he wanted to sink his teeth into a neorealistic subject. In Alfred Hitchcock, A Brief Life, Peter Aykroyd writes, he told a reporter in 1956 that, I've seen many stories about the arrest of an innocent man from the point of view of his champion, a lawyer or reporter, and so on. But it is never told from the point of view of the person who underwent the ordeal. It was the perfect story for a director who had often created films out of the crisis of the innocent being mistaken for the guilty. Hitchcock had often expressed a wish to film a documentary, and this was the closest he would ever come to it. He willingly parted company from the Technicolor and the scenic range of his most recent films, exchanging them for the black-and-white realism of a New York environment and a carefully subdued plot. This was also the period in which Italian neorealism had become popular, at least in the art houses, and Hitchcock was always keenly aware of cinematic fashion. Here's film historian and former Turner Classic Movie host Robert Osborne from Guilt Trip, Hitchcock and the Wrong Man, a short feature on the Wrong Man DVD. All of the clips in this podcast, except for the Hitchcock Truffaut bits and clips from the actual movie, oh, and one clip from the TV show, are from that short feature.
I love the movie. It's a great portrait of what New York City was like in 1956. You see so much of the city. You see the inside of the famous old Stork Club where this guy plays in the orchestra. And I think that by the middle 50s, we were seeing in this country more and more European films being imported. Everybody was getting excited about Rossellini and, you know, all the European greats were becoming the new wave. It started in France and everything, and they were getting very turned on by all that. Plus, the Hollywood type of movies with pretty people and pretty clothes and a lot of makeup and everything like that were becoming passé. So I think Hitchcock was trying to reinvent himself and also get more of that European realism. And I think he was trying to be more adventurous.
And John Russell Taylor in Hitch, The Life and Times of Alfred Hitchcock, says, it is easy enough to see what in it would have appealed to him. It reflected his long-standing neurotic fear of the police, and Balestrero's predicament could be some Kafkaesque nightmare of his own. What was less predictable was the way he chose to film it. He decided, he, the master of fantasy and film for film's sake, to film it in a semi-documentary fashion, following the real course of events exactly. Here's Paul Silbert, who was art director on the film.
Hitchcock said he wanted something quite realistic, and the reason he wanted a New York designer was he wanted someone who knew New York and was from this new school, which we came out of in working with Kazan, of very real scenery. Didn't look like scenery. The worst thing Kazan could say to you about something was, it looks fake. So he was interested in someone who could do that kind of thing, because he didn't have a lot of faith in Hollywood designers doing that for him.
To that end, he sent associate producer Herbert Coleman and writer Angus MacPhail to New York. Patrick McGilligan writes, "The New York team tried methodically to retrace Balestrero's footsteps, his habits, and experiences. Herbert Coleman himself rode the 3:30 a.m. subway train Balestrero had taken home after finishing his Stork Club gig on the night of his fateful arrest. Angus MacPhail ate breakfast at the cafe where the musician had dined that morning. And both visited the delicatessen where the real criminal was apprehended, quizzing the deli owners. Coleman and MacPhail interviewed the actual judge in the case, the defense attorney, the prosecutor, and Rose's psychiatrist. Along with Hitchcock, they visited the actual jail and observed how prisoners were booked and handled. They visited the actual psychiatric rest home." Now, the name Angus MacPhail will be familiar to you if you listen to the podcast on The Man Who Knew Too Much. He was Hitchcock's close friend, who was an alcoholic and whom many thought was being carried by Hitchcock. And although MacPhail apparently did work on The Man Who Knew Too Much, Herbert Coleman said, "The credits ought to read, script by Alfred Hitchcock, Angus MacPhail, and John Michael Hayes." Hayes successfully appealed to the Writers Guild to have MacPhail's name removed from the credits. This alienated Hitchcock from Hayes, and yet he wasn't completely finished with him at that point. According to Patrick McGilligan, "When it came to the wrong man, Hitchcock insisted that Hayes agree to collaborate with MacPhail, even stipulating in advance that they must share credit on the finished film. According to Hayes, Hitchcock even demanded that, like him, the American writer work for nothing, no salary." There is no proof of this astonishing gambit other than Hayes' recollection. Astonishing because Hitchcock must have known full well that the Writers Guild, which insisted on minimum fees for any script commissioned by a producer, would never allow such an arrangement, even if Hayes agreed. Hayes believed that Hitchcock never really expected him to take the bait. "The director knew that I couldn't do it," in Hayes's words. "If you don't come to Warner Brothers with me," Hayes quoted Hitchcock as saying, "I'll never speak to you again." Hayes refused, and that was the end of the relationship. Hitchcock, a registered coward, as Hayes liked to say, sent emissaries to tell the writer he'd been discharged. More accurately, the writer wasn't renewed. With his four-picture contract fulfilled, Hayes was kicked out of Hitchcock University. So instead of Hayes, Hitchcock asked Warner Brothers to hire Maxwell Anderson, who had written about the case before. Anderson was an acclaimed playwright, author of Key Largo, Anne of the Thousand Days, The Bad Seed, and Winter Set, which was a verse play based on the story of Sacco and Vanzetti. Maxwell Anderson wrote a number of verse plays, and Donald Spoto writes, "Hitchcock realized that he did not have the best writer for a film that was supposed to adhere meticulously to the historical detail of event, place, and time. Anderson's diction was poetic, almost fanciful, while Hitchcock wanted a sense of earthy realism, urban abrasion, and a judicious avoidance of fantasy. Anderson's delicate play High Tor, which mingled ghosts, past and present, with real people, intrigued Hitchcock and was the reason he asked him to do a first draft of his next film, Vertigo. But the wrong man was not shaping up as the literalized nightmare Hitchcock wanted." Patrick McGilligan writes, "Everything, Hitchcock insisted, ought to happen just as it had happened to the real Manny Balestrero. By phone and letter, Hitchcock kept Anderson abreast of the ongoing research, as the latter wrote in Connecticut. When Anderson placed the scene where Manny is booked and fingerprinted too early in the script, Hitchcock gently reminded the writer of the actual order of events. When Anderson wrote a speech in which a juror interrupted the proceedings to admit he has reached a guilty conclusion before hearing all the evidence, Hitchcock praised Anderson's writing, but said he couldn't use the speech in the film. Anderson had taken too much license, and the speech as written was fictitious, a major contradiction of the actual events, and could be so easily used in hostile criticism. So this is what was used instead."
"Your Honor, do we have to sit here and listen to this?"
Whenever the team hit a dry spell, they returned to the actual people, re-interviewing them for new ideas. They were amused to learn, for example, that when the real hold-up man was arrested, he cried out, "Let me go. My wife and kids are waiting for me." In the film, he says,
"Let me go. I got kids. I didn't hurt anybody."
Hitchcock told Anderson to drop that line into his working draft. "I love that line," he told François Truffaut. "It's the sort of thing you wouldn't dream of writing into a scenario." Before we get too far along, here's a summary of the film from Donald Spodo's The Art of Alfred Hitchcock. In January 1953, Christopher Emmanuel Balestrero, a musician at New York Stork Club, arrives home from work late one night. He looks in on his two sleeping sons, then talks briefly with his wife Rose, played by Vera Miles. They have financial problems, and now several hundred dollars are needed for Rose's dental work. Manny, as Balestrero is called by his family, decides to borrow money on her life insurance policy. At the insurance office next day, three office workers believe Manny is the man who recently robbed them. They notify the police, and the next night Manny is arrested as he arrives home.
"Your name, Christopher Emmanuel Balestrero?"
"Yes, it is."
"We want to speak to you. We're police officers."
"What about?"
"We'd like you to come down to the precinct and help us out a little."
"I'm just getting home. I'd like to tell my wife if I'm going anyplace."
"Well, you better come along and tell her later."
"Where is it?"
110th Precinct."
"Won't take long."
"Shouldn't take long."
"I'd like to tell my wife."
"It's all right, Chris. Just a routine matter. Down to the precinct, we'll tell you about it."
He is then taken through the neighborhood by the police, and local merchants who have also been robbed are asked if he is the right man. The similarity of his appearance and his handwriting to those of the thief lead to Manny's arrest and imprisonment on a charge of armed robbery. Relatives post bail after he spends a harrowing night behind bars. While he is being defended by a young lawyer, Frank O'Connor, played by Anthony Quayle, Manny watches Rose suffer a mental breakdown and finally is compelled to institutionalize her.
"Mr. Balestrero?"
"Yes. This is my wife."
"I think it best if you say goodbye here, Mr. Balestrero."
"Goodbye, Rose."
"Goodbye."
Alone and desperate, he is encouraged by his mother to pray for strength. As he does, an astounding coincidence occurs. His double, the actual criminal, attempts another robbery, is arrested, and Manny is freed. Rose, however, must remain in a sanitarium for two more years before her release. Patrick McGilligan writes, "The leads were locked in from the start. The wrong man was tailored for Henry Fonda and Vera Miles, two additional reasons for Hitchcock to be excited about the project. He had coveted Fonda since coming to Hollywood, trying to hire him first for Foreign Correspondent and later for Saboteur. Along with Gary Cooper and James Stewart, Fonda was one of the great John Does of the American cinema and might be expected to bring echoes of Tom Joad to his portrayal of Manny Balestrero. Peter Aykroyd describes Henry Fonda's portrayal of Manny as the epitome of grim endurance and that he became darkness made visible. He also quotes Henry Fonda as saying of Hitchcock, "He was funny all the time. Hitch would come in and tell a funny story just before he'd say roll 'em into a serious scene. I loved working with Hitch." And Fonda is great in the performance. It's hard to imagine anyone else playing Manny. Also great is Vera Miles as Rose, but she did not have the same good time that Fonda had. In The Dark Side of Genius, Donald Spodo says, "Most of the actors were required by Hitchcock for only 2 hours of work each day. Neither Fonda nor Anthony Quayle knew that behind the scenes, during the other hours of each day of production, an unpleasant scenario was being rehearsed. Vera Miles was being detained by Hitchcock for 8 and 9 hours daily, trained and put through the poignant scenes of her breakdown over and over until she was nearly sick with exhaustion." Hitchcock had begun by sending 24 American Beauty roses to Miles's dressing room each day with strangely ardent greetings, which she destroyed at once. The daily call sheets on the wrong man in the Warner Brothers archives indicate that by mid-April, the director and his leading lady were scheduled for long story conferences each day at Hitchcock's insistence, and that the rest of the cast was not required. One can infer nothing from this notation except that he wanted privacy with her. for what discussions shall perhaps never be known. But Vera Miles was soon in a state of angry resentment. On April 15th, shooting was temporarily halted, and Miles married Gordon Scott, who was in the midst of starring in a quintet of Tarzan films. From this date to the end of production in Los Angeles in early June, the private conferences between Hitchcock and Miles were less frequent, and eventually their relationship seemed back on a coolly professional keel. She had found his attentions excessive and unwelcome, his manner proprietary and suffocating. Now, we've seen Vera Miles as what Patrick McGilligan calls a shell-shocked woman in the very first episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Revenge, also directed by Hitchcock.
There he is. That's him. That's him.
In what McGilligan calls a kind of rough sketch for Rose. In The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, Donald Spoto writes, "After an attorney is hired, we move from the physical enclosure of the prison to a mental enclosure, the wife's paranoia, which results in her total emotional collapse. The ultimate irony of this family tragedy is that it occurs because of the necessity to borrow money for Rose's dental treatments. It is her insurance policy that he borrows on, and it is the insurance of her psychic life that is threatened. Unable to endure her sense of guilt, she collapses. As Manny and Rose travel to the countryside and to distant parts of New York City in search of witnesses to testify on Manny's behalf, and as these efforts are variously frustrated by the relocation or death of such witnesses, Rose becomes progressively more unstable and nervous. The key scene signifying her withdrawal from reality occurs at O'Connor's office, where we see her look of anguished retreat, a sad, distant expression which hardly changes when she is briefly brought into the conversation.
I think we may be able to make something of this. And, of course, Rose could testify to that, too.
Yes, I suppose so.
It is a harrowing scene and provides Vera Miles with one of the brilliant moments in her career. That night in their room, Rose warns Manny that the only way to win is to lock all the doors and windows and shut everyone else out.
Rose, the last few days you haven't seemed to care what happens to me at the trial.
Don't you see? It doesn't do any good to care. No matter what you do, they've got it fixed so that it goes against you. No matter how innocent you are, or how hard you try, they'll find you guilty. We're not going to play into their hands anymore. You're not going out. You're not going to the club, and the boys aren't going to school. I've thought it all over sitting here. We're going to lock the doors and stay in the house. We'll lock them out and keep them out.
Yes, maybe that's the thing to do. We won't go out any more than we have to, but there's one thing we should arrange. Whether Mother comes here, the boys go and stay with her.
You want to get the children out of the house because you think I'm crazy, don't you? Don't you? Well, you're not so perfect either. How do I know you're not crazy? You don't tell me everything you do. How do I know you're not guilty? You could be. You could be.
Rose. Rose.
You went to the loan company to borrow money for a vacation. You did that when we couldn't afford it. You always wanted to buy things on time. I told you not to. I told you they'd pile up and pile up until we couldn't meet at all.
Rose,
and
honey.
It did pile up. And then they reached in from the outside, and they put this last thing on us, and it'll beat us, and you can't win. They spoiled your alibi. They'll fix it so that they can smash us, and they will. They'll smash us down.
Thank you.
It's true, Manny. There is something wrong with me. You'll have to let them put me somewhere.
She reacts violently, picks up a hairbrush, and strikes him. For a moment, we see a split frame of his face. His image is shattered. And now the unjust legal situation is exacerbated by a more agonizing personal tragedy. Rose must be committed to an institution, and the imprisonment theme is carried forward. When Manny is finally cleared of charges and goes to tell Rose, in the hope of restoring her emotional health, the exchange between them is achingly real, the pain almost palpable.
Rose, honey, I love you. This awful nightmare we've been through, it's all over now.
That's fine for you. Fine.
For you too, Rose. It's not good for me if it isn't good for you. Doesn't it help you?
No.
Is there something I've done, Rose? Is there something you can't forgive me?
Done.
Can I help you, Rose?
Nothing can help me. No one. You can go now.
Don't you want to come with me?
Doesn't matter where I am. Where anybody is.
Here's filmmaker Peter Bogdanovich.
His wife, brilliantly played by Vera Miles, who was originally supposed to play the lead in Vertigo and got pregnant and didn't play it, and Hitchcock never forgave her. But Vera Miles plays the wife, and she gives an extraordinarily subtle and brilliant performance. And the implication is, of course, that she seems to have perhaps believed that he did do it, that he was guilty. And because of that, her guilt drives her crazy. I asked Hitchcock if that was the moral issue, and he said yes, although he regretted that because he was telling a real life story, he had to follow the story of the wife and her insanity, and therefore felt that Fonda's story collapsed. But I think that's one of the most interesting things about the picture is that it goes off into the result of what happens to the innocent people when somebody is accused of something they didn't do. And this poor wife, who perhaps has a moment of distrust, pays for it heavily. And that loss of the love between them is one of the most poignant things about the movie.
The film ends with this note. 2 years later, Rose Ballestero walked out of the sanitarium, completely cured. Today, she lives happily in Florida with Manny and the two boys. And what happened seems like a nightmare to them. But it did happen. Except, however, when Truffaut asked Hitchcock about Rose and her time in the sanitarium, Hitchcock replied, "She's probably still there." Hitchcock also tells Truffaut,
"It was designed in exactly the same manner that everything occurred.
Fidèlement, pour produire fidèlement tout ce qui s'est réellement passé.
In the same locations.
Dans les mêmes locations.
Everywhere.
Partout, les mêmes endroits."
But this doesn't necessarily mean it was filmed there. Here's Paul Silbert.
We intended to do the picture here in New York. Everything was arranged to do it here. And we shot for some time. But it was a very cold winter. And when we got to upstate New York to do the scene where they go back to the hotel or the summer place that they had been to, it was a very cold day. And Hitchcock stayed in the limousine, except for when he went into the house once, I think, at once on the porch to talk to the actors for a minute or two. And when he'd gotten that set up, he went back to the limousine. And I remember Danny McCauley, who was the assistant, and Bobby Burks, the cameraman, and I were called to the limousine. And he rolled down the window, and he put his head out a little bit, and he said, "You boys know what to do. I'm going to stay here, keep warm." And until we had to say action, he stayed in the limousine. And the next day, we got the word that we were all moving to California.
Now, Hitchcock tells Truffaut,
"Of course, by being so faithful to the original
story. Bien sûr, en étant tellement fidèle à l'histoire originelle.
There were deficiencies in the structure.
Il y avait des faiblesses dans la construction.
I don't think I've ever made a picture with such authenticity as this.
In this way, he seems to be arguing that the film has none of his Hitchcockian elements. But then he himself points one out.
I try to dramatize the discovery of the real culprit.
J'ai tâché de dramatiser la découverte du vrai coupable.
Because I showed him murmuring some prayers in front of a holy picture.
Qui murmurait des prières devant une image sainte.
And from that face.
Et de cette figure.
You remember, I dissolved to the walking figure along the street, and had one face superimpose itself over the other.
Et j'avais une figure qui était superimposée à l'autre.
Concerning this scene, film critic and historian Richard Schickel points out,
Hitchcock is loaded with Catholic symbolism, but this is the most overt Catholic symbiology that I've ever seen in a Hitchcock movie.
Paul Silbert talks about two scenes in particular, which are more Hitchcockian than documentarian. One is when Manny sits in the jail cell and the camera swirls around him. The other is the way the camera zooms in from outside the cell through the small slot in the cell door.
The principle was a Ferris wheel, which is a metal circle with a platform that is yoked on a pivot. And if you sit as you do on a Ferris wheel, and the wheel goes around, you remain level. So we built one big enough for a small camera, and Fonda, as you noticed, moved around in the frame, but the horizontality never changed. It's a strange shot because it's a subjective shot, but it's taken from an objective point of view. It isn't as if Fonda were getting dizzy and looking at the cell and the cell was spinning. It's that Fonda is spinning and Hitchcock is trying to represent his stress, but it works in the movie. It's just not what one would expect. And then the other shot was in the prison where he is shooting through a narrow slot in the door. The challenge was to see anything through a slot this big. You had to use a wide-angle lens. And he wanted to know how big to make the cell so that it didn't look enormous on that lens, how it would look like a normal cell. And I came up with this formula, and we built it to about 5.5 feet. And Henry took very small steps, and the illusion was perfect. You thought you were looking at a 9x6 cell. Not a lot of people design shots like that. Hitchcock loved making those kind of shots.
Francois Truffaut challenges Hitchcock to defend the film by saying that he feels that it is not a film that Hitchcock should have made because it is too stuck in realism and the documentary view. Hitchcock will not defend his film. And in the midst of their discussion, Truffaut does point out one scene that he feels is very much Hitchcock.
Je crois que chaque scène, une par une,
I think each scene, one by one,
est excellente,
is excellent.
Et serait très bonne dans un film d'Hitchcock.
And would have been very good in a Hitchcock film.
Mais c'est leur juxtaposition les unes à côté des autres.
But their juxtaposition of the assemblage one
qui constitue,
next to the other, which constitutes a
quelque chose de qui ne va pas.
Something that doesn't work. It seems to me.
Par exemple, la scène que je préfère.
For instance, the scene I prefer.
C'est quand l'avocat comprend.
It's when the lawyer understands.
Que Vera Miles est en train de devenir folle.
That Vera Miles is becoming crazy. Is going crazy.
C'est formidable.
It's.
Mais on est en pleine fiction.
Tremendous, but now we find ourselves in full fiction.
On est en plein film d'Hitchcock à ce moment-là.
We're in Hitchcock film land.
On ne peut plus être dans une histoire réelle.
And we can no longer be in a real life story.
On est dans une histoire mieux racontée que la réalité.
We're in a story that is better told
than
the reality.
Let's mark it down as a Warner Brothers production.
Bon, alors marquez-moi ça comme une production de Warner Brothers.
Non, je serais très content que vous défendiez le film.
No,
si
I would love to hear you defend the picture if you.
I don't feel that strongly about it.
Non, eh bien mes sentiments ne sont pas assez forts pour.
Before we wrap up, I do want to mention the music by Bernard Herrmann that fits into the movie beautifully. Here is Christopher Husted, the manager of the Bernard Herrmann estate.
Bernard Herrmann's work with Hitchcock on The Wrong Man was his third film with the director, and Herrmann's music was probably successful primarily in Hitchcock's films because it was very spare, it was very restrained in its construction. It wasn't very heavy and romantic. It wasn't driven by long themes. Instead, he used very short themes. And Herrmann's music on The Wrong Man is restrained. It is insistent, even irritating at times, especially the passages involving the muted trumpets, which have a certain stinging sound, much as Manny feels the sting of uncertainty and fear at being pursued by the police without understanding why. But despite the fact that The Wrong Man is notorious for being a very grim and bleak film, Herrmann indulges in a certain degree of lyricism in the scenes that involve the home life. And again, the problem of the score's insistence on very repetitive and simple music brings these lyrical oases into relief very immediately.
In his book, François Truffaut quotes Hitchcock as saying, "Well, let's file The Wrong Man among the indifferent Hitchcocks." In his book, Peter Aykroyd writes, "It has gravity, but no lightness. Despite its pretense to realism, it seems too schematic and labored to carry it off." And in his book, Patrick McGilligan quotes Danny Perry from The Guide for the Film Fanatic, who says, "First part of the picture, in which Fonda is arrested outside his home, questioned, fingerprinted, paraded in front of witnesses, and tossed into jail, is masterfully directed with a sense of precision that's even above Hitchcock's usual standards. This Kafka-esque sequence is so frightening that everything that comes afterward seems anticlimactic." But Peter Bogdanovich says,
"This wasn't one of his most successful films. In fact, it wasn't particularly successful at all. But it's very, very effectively done picture, kind of documentary almost. And Hitchcock used to say that he thought maybe he'd made a mistake by not making it more documentary and less Hitchcockian in the way he shot it. I don't agree. I think The Wrong Man is one of the most emotional of Hitchcock's pictures, told with extraordinary restraint and a sense of reality. Just the opposite of the kind of artifice that Hitchcock's famous for and that he popularized. And The Wrong Man is a perfect example of the kind of Hitchcock that you don't expect, which is what gives it part of its extraordinary impact as a film."
And I agree with Bogdanovich. It's a very sad film. It's not the sort of film you'll watch over and over again, as you might say Rear Window, but it's powerful in its starkness. It does have its nice share of Hitchcock moments. And through its minute examination of the judicial system, it, as Donald Spoto writes in The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, shows mistrust and fear directed at the whole of society, at the tenuous psychological structures we build as a defense against that society, the sense of dislocation amid urban life which leads to the confusion of identities, or what the Encyclopedia of Alfred Hitchcock calls the transfer of guilt, the stain of guilt transferred from the actual criminal to Manny and then transferred to Rose because of the ramifications that surround an appearance of guilt. So it's not just the look of the film, but the themes that swirl around it that make it seem very appropriate for the television show. You can almost view it as a 1 hour and 45 minute episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. According to Wikipedia, Rose died in Florida in 1982 at the age of 72. Despite the claim in the film's epilogue, Rose never fully recovered after her nervous breakdown. Manny outlived his wife by 16 years, dying in North Carolina at the age of 88. A street is named Manny the Wrong Man Ballestrero Way at 73rd Street and 41st Avenue in Jackson Heights, New York. The street is not far from the former real-life Ballestrero home. The Wrong Man, including the short feature Guilt Trip, Hitchcock and the Wrong Man, and Alfred Hitchcock Presents Season 1, are available at the Ann Arbor District Library. The Hitchcock Truffaut discussions are available online. If you would like to contact me about this podcast, please email me at sjoe@aadl.org. That's sjoerdsmaa@aadl.org. And please put Hitchcock somewhere in the subject line. Back to our regularly scheduled programming next time.
Good night. Thank you.